let's be clear, and maybe it's not so much of a newsflash. A peace process is not itself a peaceful process. Negotiations do not occur in a vacuum. Crises are often made worse because of the context in which they occur, and these can include preceding crises or acts of violence or progress in the peace process. And understanding how crises undermine the legitimacy of that peace process can help determine what measures may effectively insulate peacemaking from the efforts of outside spoilers to violently undermine ongoing negotiations over long festering ethnic conflicts. Or at least that's what I tried to do. And I'll spare you all the methodology and the academic discourse. Raymond, I'll give it to you later. Or maybe you'll buy the book. But consider just these three cases, which I focused on in the book. The February 1994 Hebron massacre by Baruch Goldstein, the November 1994 kidnapping and murder of Israeli soldier and dual U.S. citizen Nachshon Waxman, and the February-March 1996 string of terrorist attacks, in particular suicide bus bombings. After a rocky start following the declaration of the signing of the Declaration of Principles, Israeli-Palestinian negotiators began to gain momentum in the weeks leading up to the 94 Hebron massacre. But while they made some promising progress on security issues and civilian and economic talks in Davos and Taba, in Cairo and in Paris, some of these may be familiar to you, Dennis, the same period also saw a rise in attacks and reprisals in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and a noticeable increase in anti-Oslo rhetoric from both Palestinian and Israeli rejectionist groups. And then very early on a Friday morning, during the Jewish holiday of Purim and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, Baruch Goldstein arrived at the Cave of the Patriarchs, the Ibrahimi Mosque, carrying his government-issued rifle, and in front of some 500 Muslim worshippers kneeled in prayer, unloaded four magazines, over 100 bullets, killed about 30 people, wounded hundreds more, and only a jammed clip prevented the killer from loading yet a fifth magazine and killing more. Later that year, in August of 94, Israeli representatives of the newly created PA signed an accord on the early transfer of a litany of powers from Israel to the PA in parts of the territories not included in the Gaza-Jericho agreement signed earlier that May. The agreement passed responsibility for all kinds of services, education, culture, health, social welfare, direct taxation, and tourism, among others, from Israeli to Palestinian administration. Then, building on that milestone, and despite some rocky negotiations, Israeli-Palestinian economic, security, and political committees met to discuss such issues as Palestinian elections, safe passage between the Gaza Strip and West Bank, and foreign aid. In fact, in September, Peres and Arafat reached an agreement in Oslo on a $22.3 billion aid package for the autonomous Palestinian areas. The second half of September, however, ushered in a series of speed bumps in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiation process. In contrast to the increasingly steady progress of Israeli-Jordanian negotiations then also underway, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators collided over the issue of prisoner releases in particular, which was already becoming the sticking point by which other disagreements, and they were many, would be measured. On October 9th, two Hamas assailants opened fire with automatic weapons on a row of sidewalk cafes in Jerusalem. And then later that same day, though it would only become known about a day and a half later, Hamas terrorists dressed as observant Jews drove to a hitchhiking station near Ben Gurion Airport in the heart of Israel and kidnapped Nachshon Waxman. They abducted him to a safe house near Jerusalem in Bir Nabala. And they released a videotape, which was released in the Gaza Strip, fooling Palestinian and Israeli intelligence both into thinking that the kidnappers and Nachshon Waxman were being held in Gaza. The two videos that were released created a week of national trauma within Israel. And for the first time, the Palestinian Authority security services seriously were engaged in cooperating with Israeli services to find Nachshon Waxman. At the end of that week, that Friday morning, Israeli authorities learned, with the help, significant help, from Palestinian Authority security services, that Waxman was not being held in the Gaza Strip, but in Bir Nabala, in an area of the West Bank under Israeli control, not under Palestinian control yet. They raided the house. It was a botched raid, and Waxman was killed in the process. Terrorist attacks of various intensities continued to plague the peace process as it continued through 95 and 96. But despite the violence of extremists opposed to the peace talks, Israeli and Palestinian negotiators made several significant achievements. In September 95, negotiators concluded the interim agreement, Oslo II, on the transfer of powers in the West Bank from Israel to the Palestinian Authority. That quickly led to tangible results, created visible changes on the ground, and gave the PA increased powers and legitimacy. In fact, Israeli forces handed over control of West Bank cities to Palestinian control ahead of schedule, which may well be the only example of its kind over the course of this peace process. In October 95, a Jewish extremist, Yigal Amir, assassinated Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, and an increasingly unnerved Israeli society suffered no less than 6 suicide bombing attacks and many others in the period between the 94 Waxman abduction and the string of suicide bus bombings in February and March 1996. Over the course of the same period, Israeli extremists also attempted to undermine the peace process, although their one spectacular attack was thwarted. That was in January 1996 when Shin Bet agents arrested David Ben-Ariel, an American Jewish extremist who moved to Israel, a member of the fundamentalist Temple Mount Faithful, for an alleged plot to bomb the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Haram al-Sharif in Jerusalem. In January 2006, Oslo II was ratified by the Israeli Knesset, although by a very slim majority. The PA held its first elections for the president and for the Palestinian Legislative Council. Also in January, the Israelis assassinated their chief Hamas antagonist, Hamas bombmaker Yahya Yash, known as the Engineer. And then in February, in a sign the democratic Israeli political system remained stable even after the Rabin assassination, Paris set elections for May 1996. And then on February 24th, that morning, a Hamas suicide bomber blew up the number 18 bus in Jerusalem. An hour later, a bus stop near Ashkelon was targeted. The next day, a car rammed into Israeli civilians in an attack that was later tied to the Islamic Jihad. Tremendous security measures were put in place. A closure was enforced, complete closure in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. A couple of days later, on the 28th, a Hamas raid on a settlement was foiled in the West Bank. And just as Israelis began to think that they had things under control, because no security measures like these had ever been put in place, on March 3rd, almost a week to the minute after the first bombing of the number 18 bus in Jerusalem, the number 18 bus was hit again, just a few blocks away from what had been the first time, and a message that was read loud and clear that Hamas could attack any time, any place, despite whatever measures Israel put in place. The literature abounds on the needs for conflict to be ripe for resolution, the timing of efforts to settle or resolve conflicts, the need to establish momentum for successful negotiation. Missing is an effort to understand those factors involving preserving that ripeness and maintaining the timely environment and sustaining momentum, especially in the context of the crises we know are going to happen. More than anything else, terrorist attacks upset negotiation processes by first freezing whatever positive momentum the parties had established, and then injecting significant countervailing momentum that undermines the ability and the willingness both of the parties to continue negotiating. Leaders find themselves unable or unwilling, or both, to pursue a peace policy when events cut into the public's approval and support for the leaders themselves and the legitimacy of their regime, their regime legitimacy, their authority as negotiators, into the policy of negotiation itself, the policy legitimacy, and the perceived credibility of the other party. Terror attacks strike at the heart of these factors of legitimacy, forcing decision makers from each party to turn defensively inward and secure renewed diplomatic domestic support for themselves, their policies of negotiation, and the credibility of the other party in the eyes of their constituencies. The need to settle political issues at home, whether issues of legitimacy such as balancing concessions with the associated political costs, or questions of personal security after a massive attack, take precedence over the need to build confidence with the negotiators across the table. Terrorist attacks also prompt the central questions, once back at the negotiating table, how do negotiators cope with both the loss of faith in one another and the underlying question of whether the opposing negotiators remain legitimate spokesmen of their people? Do they have the authority to make concessions and live up to their end of any settlement? Without successfully selling the policy of negotiation at home all over again, and in the absence of positive answers to these questions, negotiations cannot successfully resume. And then if and when they do resume, what changes have been made to these factors like negotiator authority, policy legitimacy and credibility in the eyes of the other party that collectively form the totality of the negotiating environment. Certain tactics are no longer available in the post-crisis phases of negotiations, and others have suddenly materialized. While every concession and agreement will now face extra scrutiny, measuring its marginal utility against the cost to legitimacy, events offer empowered decision-makers with leverage against opposition factions among the public and the government and with negotiators for the other party. So after the Waxman attack, Arafat suddenly found himself in a position to say, no, we actually do have to do something to crack down on Hamas. And then after he really didn't keep that up when the 1996 attacks happened, after the first one where he really didn't do very much at all, by the time the second 18 bus was exploded, he again felt empowered to say, no, we actually have to do something. Or after the Baruch Goldstein massacre, Israeli leaders felt that they had a mandate to seriously consider removing settlers from Hebron, which they didn't do in the end for other reasons having to do with addressing final status issues earlier on in the process, but it enabled them and empowered them. And so terrorist attacks undermine these three types of legitimacy, which is the cornerstone of how they upend the negotiation process. In terms of the policy legitimacy, the legitimacy of the policy of pursuing a negotiated peaceful settlement, terrorist attacks seriously undercut the popular support within each party for the policy of continuing negotiations. Leaders and publics alike question the legitimacy of such a policy when the process that is supposed to usher in an era of peace produces instead an increase in terror attacks. Decision makers find themselves in an unenviable position of trying to explain to a public in mourning that peace processes themselves are rarely, if ever, peaceful processes. In the Goldstein case, for example, 77.3% of Palestinians opposed a return to negotiations either outright or unless additional conditions were met. In terms of the legitimacy of the regime or their authority as negotiators, the abduction and subsequent murder of Corporal Waxman, for example, generated serious challenges to the negotiator authority of both Israeli and Palestinian decision makers. At the same time that these leaders were thrust on the defensive in terms of justifying their peace policy, they were also facing challenges to their own legitimacy as leaders and therefore to their mandates as fully empowered negotiators for their people. Keep in mind that in the middle of this attack, Rabin, Peres, and Arafat were informed that they were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Israeli leaders sought to dispel the notion that the brazen Hamas attack was indicative of an underlying flaw in the peace policy in which Rabin had become personally identified. Having wrapped himself and his government so tightly in the mantle of the peace process, Rabin's fate, Peres's fate, Arafat's fate, became entirely intertwined with that peace process. Palestinian leaders sought to counter the perception, on the other hand, that while Hamas took action and delivered on its promises, Arafat negotiated and negotiated, but failed to deliver on key aspects of the peace process, such as prisoner release, which at the time had been one of the issues about to be settled, and which Hamas had made the condition for the release of Nachshon Waxman. And finally, in terms of credibility to the other party, the suicide bombing crisis in spring of 1996 did not occur, like any of these others, in a political vacuum. Going into the crisis, each party already felt there was a gap in the credibility of the other party. Israelis felt Palestinians had yet to engage in the kind of counterterrorism crackdown, sustained crackdown, required of them under the peace accords, while Palestinians felt Israel was dragging its feet on several of its peace process obligations, such as prisoner releases, dealing with Israeli settlements, and implementing redeployment of Israeli forces from Palestinian populated areas. From the stated perspective of each side, the February-March bombing crisis was a direct result of the other's intransigence, which further undermined the credibility of each side in the eyes of the other. So let's be clear. Oslo failed. Nothing personal. Perhaps the peace process was doomed from the outset, as some might certainly argue. Both sides failed to meet their negotiation obligations, with Palestinian violence continuing to target Israelis and Israeli settler activity continuing throughout the peace process. When the parties did meet their obligations, they invariably did so behind schedule, in fits and starts. Among Israelis and their supporters, some have concluded the Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority never really intended to forswear violence and live in peace side by side with Israel. Among Palestinians and some of their supporters, some concluded that Israel and its leaders never intended to end the occupation and enable the emergence of a sovereign Palestinian government. That may indeed have been the case for some decision makers on each side, but others clearly labored, in some cases at great personal expense, for the success of what, by all accounts, started out as an unexpected and historic breakthrough. Despite its inherent flaws and the fact that it ultimately did fail, was there anything that could have been done at the time to increase the odds of its success? And frankly, completely aside from whether it was a good process or a bad process, if there were to be a good process, can it be insulated from the impact of the outside spoilers? Dennis Ross, who some of you may know, once wrote, "One critical lesson of the Oslo period is that no negotiation is likely to succeed if there is one environment on the negotiating table and another one on the street. Negotiations did not take place in a vacuum. They are affected by daily events and unpleasant realities." We have to take this heart, this message to heart. It seems to me painfully obvious that these types of attacks are going to happen, that the parties are going to have very serious domestic political constraints on their willingness and ability to crack down on their domestic extremists, and we've seen this on both sides of this particular conflict, which means that there have to be, I think, two macro types of ways to address this. First of all, there has to be an effort to preemptively insulate the process. And then there has to be, in advance, some type of crisis response that is agreed upon. In terms of preemptive insulation, and I will let you read the details in the book, what I've highlighted are a few ideas, and there are many, many others, I'm sure. But for starters, there needs to be pre-negotiation on a whole host of issues. And here I don't mean a meeting to have a meeting about the meeting, but issues that will be agreed upon before the process of negotiation over the actual settlement occurs. How will we respond to certain types of crises? What is our response going to be when these crises happen? Pre-negotiation discussions of these issues would provide a crisis-free baseline, a framework for post-crisis negotiations on the response. Trying to figure out how we're going to respond when we're already facing the crisis is not wise. Second, it's clear to me anyway that there has to be some very serious implementation verification. One of the critical problems that happened, and it's not only this peace process, but almost everyone I looked at, is that failure or delayed implementation of each party's responsibilities created conditions that the spoilers were then able to play upon and created an environment in which it was very, very difficult for each party then to crack down on their extremists who said, no, we're actually just trying to get the other party to do what it's supposed to do. Third, it's obvious that we have to deal with the negative momentum, but these three cases reveal to me anyway the need for positive momentum. It's not enough to insulate the process from the negative baggage, but a positive negotiating environment has to be nurtured to shepherd the process through difficult times. And I have a bunch of suggestions in the book. What is important in the long run, Dr. Haider Abdel-Shafi once wrote, is not the spontaneous and natural response of the people, but whether the process is leading toward the fulfillment of our rights. Or in the words of former Israeli Finance Minister Dan Meridor, the peace process was like being on a bicycle. One must keep pedaling lest you crash and fall off. The logic of creating positive momentum is not just to prevent a crash and fall, but to keep up the party's hope and optimism that tangible process is possible in the foreseeable future. And that hope is very, very important. Next, leaders need to be vested in the process. And at some points in this process, leaders clearly were. They were so wrapped in the mantle of the peace process that they were, in some ways, too vested in it. But to the extent they are vested in a process, they will be willing to take bold steps, sometimes leading by example instead of following their people. And in the context of a difficult negotiation over festering ethno-nationalist conflict, that sometimes is going to be necessary. And then the last category here in terms of preemptive insulation is broadening grassroots support. An Israeli negotiator said that the ingrained mutual suspicion between Israelis and Palestinians about this, he said, the basic thing is that the basis for negotiations is a degree of mutual trust so that you can negotiate in good faith and compromise. And in the absence of that kind of faith and compromise, public support for peace decreases and violence increases. According to Palestinian scholar Khalil Shkaki, support for violence among Palestinians is dependent on the Palestinian perception of the threat posed to them. And the Israeli psyche is similarly affected, a fact recognized by Hamas. Commenting on the impact of Hamas attacks on the Israeli public, Jamal Salim, a Hamas operative from Nablus, noted that continued attacks affect you psychologically and noted, quote, "If one Israeli is killed, thousands go to see their psychiatrists." And then the second major issue is crisis response. The authors of the 9/11 Commission Report opened their chapter on emergency response by saying, emergency response is a product of preparedness. And indeed, devastating security crises are going to take place. How we deal with them is something we need to address in advance. And these have to include things like crisis response operating procedures. What are going to be the outline, basic principles for hot pursuit, following someone to someone else's territory after an attack? Will there be dedicated radio frequencies? What is going to be the nature, and not in general, but very specific terms, of intelligence coordination? Better intelligence coordination, for example, could have prevented the riots that ensued in the West Bank and Gaza following the 94 Goldstein attack in Hebron, which made that horrific terrorist attack much, much worse. And in contrast, intelligence cooperation was a critical key to the relative success, that is, in finding Waxman, although he was ultimately killed in the raid, of resolving that crisis. Communication. Specifically, what are going to be the manners and means of keeping open channels of communication, not only at the senior level, but at the much lower level between lower-level persons between the Israelis and Palestinians in the context of a crisis? And finally, there is an absolutely clear need to keep the streets as calm as possible. And what I noticed as I looked at these cases, the clear absence of efforts in almost every case, though not every case, the clear absence of efforts by one party to try and help the other party overcome the threats to their legitimacy was very, very telling. One Palestinian security official noted that to affect public opinion, both sides need to reassert themselves to the people on the other side's street. First, about maintaining serious direct talks, and second, on the number of measures adopted by both sides to address the people on the street on an economic or a security level. In several of these crises, the most important thing that could have happened, and in a few small cases did, was when Israeli leaders reached out and tried to bolster, not necessarily the bear hug, their Palestinian counterparts and vice versa. In conclusion, a former Israeli intelligence official cautioned that we need to take into consideration the fact that extremists from both sides will remain even if we sign a whole, complete peace treaty with the Palestinians, above and beyond the fact that the peace process itself is not a peaceful process. These facts, notwithstanding, anticipating the terror attacks will threaten, that terrorist attacks will threaten the peace process, does empower decision makers, if they so choose, to take proactive measures to preemptively insulate the process against the challenges to the legitimacy of the policy of negotiating, to the legitimacy of the leaders engaged in the negotiations, and to the credibility of the other party. Having anticipated such crises, the parties are able to fashion guidelines for effective response geared not only toward managing the crisis, but toward doing so in such a way that the resulting feedback loop encourages a resumption of negotiations. The party's response to a crisis, a key factor of decision makers' perception of the crisis intensity, above and beyond the nature of the crisis itself, are as important in terms of the impact on decision makers' willingness and ability to return to the negotiating table. Reactions to the crisis can alternatively calm or aggravate the intensity of the crisis, or ease or complicate the resumption of the negotiations. The implications of these ideas for today's prospects for peace are many, but for that, I will leave you to Raif and Dennis.